Hey there, listeners. This is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. Audible.com is offering Beyond the Uniform listeners one free audiobook. You can see this offer, as well as a list of every book guests have recommended on the show, at beyondtheuniform.io/books. That's beyondtheuniform.io/books. Thanks and enjoy the show.
Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today's episode number 58 with Dwayne Franz.
There still maybe is a stigma in the community. There's an idea that veterans are seen as one of three ways. Either they're a victim, you know, they're this broken winged bird that needs to be nursed back to life, or they're a villain. They're a crazy combat vet that's about to explode any minute now. Or they're seen as some kind of mythic hero, you know, some kind of vindicator that will stand up. And none of those things are really true. No veteran that I've ever known wants to be treated like a victim. Being labeled a villain or in some way aggressive or something, that could make them more aggressive. A lot of veterans will resist against being called a hero. You know, that I know heroes, but I'm not a hero. And so there are these kind of archetypes that maybe the community sees. When you see veteran, you see one of these three things. But in reality, we're really kind of a combination of all of them.
The top two reasons to listen to today's episode are, number one, responsibility. Dwayne has devoted his career to helping veterans and has established himself as a veteran mental health thought leader. In this episode, he talks about the main problems addressing the veteran community. You may think this doesn't apply to you, but if it doesn't, it definitely affects some of the people you served with. Dwayne has great advice that would be helpful to anyone who served in the military. Number two, counselor. Dwayne retired in the military and then approached his second career as a clinical mental health counselor. If you're interested in this industry, he's a great role model to follow. As always, there are more resources at beyondtheuniform.io, additional episodes, data, ebooks, a directory of veteran services, and more. And with that, let's dive in to my interview with Dwayne Franz.
Joining me today in Colorado Springs, Colorado, is Dwayne Franz. Dwayne, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to give listeners a quick background on you. Dwayne serves as the program director for the Colorado Veteran Health and Wellness Agency, as well as the director of veteran services for the Family Care Center, and also as a clinical mental health counselor. He started out as a non-commissioned officer in the Army, where he served for 22 years with 5 combat and operational deployments. Since leaving the Army, he has established himself as a veteran mental health thought leader, being listed by LinkedIn as one of the top 5 most influential veterans on LinkedIn. You can find him online at his website at veteranmentalhealth.com and on Twitter as the TH Consulting Vet. And just a reminder for listeners, I'll add links in the show notes to Dwayne's website and all the different things we talk about. So, Dwayne, maybe to start things off, if you could take us back to that moment when you decided to leave the Army and how you approached that decision.
Yeah, sure. So that's pretty interesting. I don't know that there was I know that there were many more moments. It was really kind of a series, a process of things where I decided, you know, I was always, as I went through my career, when I was at 10 years, I was certain that I would stay until 30. Once I hit 15 years, I figured I'd make it to 25. And so the closer I got to 20 years, I really was trying to, you know, figure out how long I was going to stay in. And one of the big things for me, see, I've been here at Fort Carson, or was stationed here at Fort Carson since 2006, and we decided this is where we were going to stay, this is where we were going to retire, and I had one final deployment to Afghanistan in 2011 and 2012, and the plan was to come back, maybe do about another year. That would get me about right at 20 years. You know, just kind of ride off in the sunset. By that time, I'd already started my master's degree. a little bit more backstory. I was airborne in the Army. I served 3 years in the 82nd back in the late 90s, and had spent most of my career trying to get back into the airborne community, and thought when I got here to Carson in 06 that I was going to be able to join up with 10th Special Forces Group and jump again. And the Army decided that wasn't going to happen. So I kind of hung that dream back on the shelf. And then as I was leaving Afghanistan, They gave me orders to 10th Special Forces Group Support Battalion, which was what I was looking for all along. So that really kind of delayed my retirement for a couple of years, that I got to do what I wanted to do at the end of the year or at the end of my career. Unfortunately, got hurt on a jump, 2012. Jumping when you're 38 years old is a lot different than jumping when you're like 25. So getting hurt on the jump and realizing that, you know, the whole process wasn't exactly what I wanted to continue to do, that I ended up getting out. And it was the beginning of 2013. I just got back from North Africa with a training event with some with some partner nations. And my wife and I sat down and said, we'll take a hard look at it, and decided to get out in August of 14. So it was really a long process that kind of got diverged several different places along the path.
And what brought you or attracted you to the mental health profession? It sounds like you had started that process by getting your master's degree on active duty. What was it about that profession that drew you in?
Well, I had I started the process while I was on active duty, but then didn't complete my master's until I had been retired. It just kind of overlapped about 6 or 7 months. But for me, it took me a really long time to kind of decide what I wanted to be when I grew up. You know, it was I always envisioned myself as, you know, one of those cool high school English or history teachers that the kids could derail by asking them about their combat, you know, experience and stuff, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of what I thought that I was going to do. I was in Iraq in 06, 07, and I was already in E7, Sergeant First Class, by then. And one of the guys that worked for me came in with his associate's degree. He showed it up, and he showed it to me, and he's like, "So what's your degree in, Sergeant?" I said, "My degree's in none of your business," you know, because I didn't have that. You know, I was so focused on it, especially, you know, you're focused on deployments, you're focused on training. And I hadn't even really considered at that point what I wanted to do after the military. So with a little bit of his prodding and a little bit of, well, if he can do it, I can do it kind of thing, I started off and I enrolled in an associate's degree. Still at then, mental health wasn't the thing. I was interested in psychology. I'd, you know, taken a whack at college before, and one of the only things that interested me was an intro to psych course. So when I called up the education center, I told them, you know, I'd like to get it started in a degree, and whatever degree that has the least amount of math possible, that's the one for me. So that's when, you know, they came and they said there was an associate's in applied counseling and applied psychology. So I started off that way. And then when we got back from that Iraq tour, in about 05, 06 is when they really started focusing on reintegration from the deployments. And there was one, we had like a 3-day reintegration fair, I guess you could call it. A lot of the briefings where they bring in, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Driving and, you know, different resources in the community. And we had, our company was taken to a breakout room that a counselor from our local vet center was there, and she had mentioned that if any of us were interested in the mental health counseling field, that we should look at it as a profession, because there are not enough combat veterans in the mental health counseling field. She herself was a retired major, and that's how the vet centers around the nation are generally staffed, with veterans themselves. And so it really kind of was a convergence there that, you know, it's like, oh, I'm already on this path, and I started looking more into it. And that's true. It really was something, A, that I was interested in, B, that there was obviously a need for.
And you work in a variety of capacities right now. What would you want listeners to know about the different roles and the different capacities in which you work?
Well, I am on the staff of a what is considered kind of a large mental health counseling agency, the Family Care Center. And so in one aspect of my role, I'm really kind of in charge of their veterans program. All of our therapists are either veterans themselves like me, or you know, familiar with, like spouses, or we've been working with veterans for a long time. So in that role, I'm really marketing and outreach and things like that. But I also oversee a program that we have for providing counseling to our local veterans court. Through the work that we're doing with the local veterans court, I saw that there was a need to provide no-cost mental health counseling services for veterans that are not in in the justice system. So we established a 501c3, and so it's a nonprofit arm of the for-profit agency. We're affiliated, but we're separate entities because it's challenging, especially in the mental health field, to separate fund development and fund acquisition from actual service delivery. And so at the beginning of this year, we started that process. We received a grant. So I, in addition to the outreach director for that, for the Family Care Center, I'm the executive director of the nonprofit arm.
And for people who might be interested in this sort of work, I always think it's helpful to paint that picture of the day, a day in the life. And, you know, while recognizing that no day is typical, I'm just wondering, like, what would an average day look like in terms of what time you get started and what sort of things you do throughout the day?
You know, that is, especially in this field, there is no typical day. It really depends on, office hours, when clients can get there and when veterans can come in. I work actually 6 different days a week, some hours here and some hours there, just because, I need to be able to be responsive for when the veterans come in. That's one of the challenges that some veterans have with the Department of Veterans Affairs. It's kind of a 9-to-5 thing. They are doing much better now at establishing after hours type stuff. But it's hard to be that much more flexible. So, Wednesdays is my late day. So I'm in the office seeing veterans until, 8 o'clock at night, Saturday mornings, that kind of thing. But typically, that's what it is you come in and I sit down and I, work with veterans. We standard counseling session, an hour at a time, and that's pretty much it. It's just the hours are very flexible because you need to be responsive for what the veteran needs.
That's great. I mean, I don't think I put that together until you said that, but it's like it's something where I imagine it's a step of courage for a lot of veterans to be proactive in meeting with someone like you. And then on top of that, if the hours are conflicting with their day job, it makes it even harder for them to see you. And so that ability to meet them on weekends or meet them after hours, I imagine has a pretty big impact.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, and it's not just a barrier to meet us. It could be a reason why they don't, I think I might need to, but I really got to work today, or it'd be hard for me to, ask the boss for a day off or something like that. I'd have to tell them why. All of these different, internal barriers, and for a lot of veterans that are looking to seek help, any reason would be a good reason to say, no, I'm really not going to do it. So, we do our best to accommodate the needs of the veterans. Early mornings too, Tuesday mornings, I'm in the office by 7. So if a veteran needs to come in before, they start the work day or however it works.
And I wanted to learn a little bit more about advice for other people who want to get into this work. I know for you that on your road to your civilian career, you earned your bachelor's of science in psychology and then a master's in clinical mental health counseling. I'm wondering what has been the most helpful for you in preparing for this career, and what advice would you give to other veterans who are looking to get into similar work?
Well, I think one of the big things is to make sure that you're interested in doing this kind of stuff. I've talked to people before and said that this is really an extension of what I did as a leader in the Army. If your soldiers are coming to you, or if your airman or your Marine is coming to you and you're the one that they come to for advice and counsel, and you enjoy, you know, doing that, then that's probably a good indicator that this might be the field for you. You know, it's on one level, it is as basic as mentorship, which is huge, and a lot of veterans recognize that just from their time in the military. But it's the process of, you know, explaining what's going on and hearing someone else's point of view. So that's a big thing, is really if you're not the one that that the veteran, you know, that your soldiers, your subordinates are always coming to you with things, then maybe this isn't for you. And I think for me, really, it was at the point where I decided I was ready to go back to college. I by that time it had the discipline and really the attention to detail to do so. So that's really the big thing, is figuring out what you want, and then doing the research there. And especially in the mental health counseling field, I didn't know what I needed to know to become a fully licensed mental health professional whenever I started my associate's degree. Thankfully, I didn't have to at that point, but as I got to certain decision points in my career or in my educational progression, I very deliberately slowed down and reached out to other professionals in the field and said, okay, what do I need to do? There was actually at one point where I was looking at a PhD program versus a master's program, and I had an excellent mentor who had gone through the same process, who said that the one PhD program I was looking at, it wasn't accredited. And the master's program, he said, if you go through these master's programs, they are. And he said, if I were a clinician looking to hire another clinician, I would hire the master's level accredited person before I would hire the doctorate unaccredited person. And so things like that, doing the research, and it would be like that in any industry. But if you do not, especially for someone who's looking in the mental health counseling profession, if you don't go through steps, you know, X, Y, Z, where you're doing, you can really get pretty far off and actually be deep into a master's level or a doctoral program that may not get you where you want to be.
Yeah, that's great advice. I can only imagine how frustrating that would have been if you had just invested so much time and energy and changed your life to go after something and then realized it wasn't going to get you where you wanted to go, or there was some little nuance that prevented it from being as helpful as you would want it to be. And I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk more about your work, because I think what you're doing is so vital for any veterans and their families, and I wanted to just ask you a series of questions in that vein. And so the first thing I was curious about was you have a great post, and I'll link to that in the show notes, that's called "Let's Talk About Vets for a Minute." And in this, you talk about your firsthand experience with the difficulty veterans often experience expressing their experience in the military to others. And I was wondering if you could share more about that story.
Yeah. So, and that's something that that I call, you know, the paradox of the veteran's story. The veteran, when they come back, they face this paradox of, I really want people to understand what I went through, and at the same time, I don't want to talk about it at all. And so that happened after that. The story that you're talking about happened after my first Afghanistan deployment in 2009-2010. During that deployment, I was a platoon sergeant of a security escort platoon. We escorted local national Afghan vehicles from different bases, and it was the most challenging deployment. It was obviously the most kinetic deployment. We got in quite a few firefights and IEDs, and regrettably lost someone in our company. And so it was a challenging deployment. But also, when I look back at my series deployments, it was almost kind of the best of times. You know, that deployment, my first Iraq deployment, those veterans or those soldiers, those ones I stay most in contact with. So, when we got back, my wife's father was ill, and so we had gone on our block leave, and we'd gone back home to Tennessee. My brother-in-law and I were building a deck for them, for my R-in-laws, And with how quick things go, literally it had been a week before that I was out on the route. It had been, just less than a month that, between my last firefight, everything was still very fresh in my mind. And, here we were in beautiful, town outside of Knoxville, Tennessee, wonderful summer day. But everybody seemed like, well, there was nothing going on, that they didn't know that literally there was a war going on half a world away. And we had a pretty good replacement, and I had some good rapport with the platoon sergeant and the team that replaced us. and so they kept our schedule, and so I would be sitting there looking at my watch saying, well, I know where they're at, right? They'd be leaving the wire right now, or they'd be on the route at this time, and half of my mind would be over there, and then the other half would be, everybody's just standing around, joking and laughing and not really totally oblivious to what was going on. And there were, times where I'd be screaming in my head almost, just, frustrated. Why are you pretending? Why are you not, asking things? So after about 4 or 5 days of this, my brother-in-law, great guy, just a really awesome dude. Finally, at the end of the day, he and I were leaning back and we had a couple beers. And then he asked me, he was like, so what was it like over there? And literally all the way up until that moment, I wanted him to ask so I could tell him. And then at that second, it immediately flipped and I couldn't. I was like, yeah, it was rough. It was just something I just kind of blew it off. And looking back on that, that's really a lot of what the veterans struggle with. They want people to know what they experienced. They want people to know what happened. And then at the same time, when people actually want to hear that, the veteran has a very hard time explaining that or expressing that. So it's really kind of getting over that first initial hesitance and going with the first instinct that helps veterans kind of move forward with telling the story.
It's just so interesting because it sounds like, what you're saying is exactly what the veteran needs, precisely what they need of being able to express that and have connection through that story is also, it turns out to be one of the more difficult things for them and something they don't know how to do. And I'm just wondering, what advice do you have for veterans in getting past that, of taking that first step or of becoming more comfortable in those situations?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is to be aware that it's, the unknown is not as bad as you think it's going to be. And it's just a matter of stepping out and doing it, just really getting over there. We call it breaking the seal, like breaking the seal on the bottle or breaking the seal on your gas mask. It may be something that is frightening or is overwhelming or you don't know about it, but just to do it. I spent, the Army has a really great behavioral modification technique called airborne school, and they spend, a week just getting you to go over and over, jumping off of small walls and jumping out of towers. Then finally in the third week that you jump out of the airplanes because it's something that you do that's so automatic that you don't think about it. And so that's really the big thing is if there is a challenge, if there is something, a barrier that you're experiencing, just push through it. We've done that in our military careers before, and it wasn't as bad as we thought. And in this way, the hesitation is actually potentially more harmful than actually going through the action would ever be.
That's great. And in another post, you talk about how, and I'm quoting, the numerous difficulties that some veterans experience, including unemployment, homelessness, and transitioning difficulties, are all related to their mental health in some form or fashion. And I was wondering, what stands in the way of veterans realizing this, that this single thing poses so many problems throughout the veteran community?
Well, I think that, the veterans' mindset, the way that they think about and see the world is the basis of everything else. But it's also internal and it's not very conscious, so veterans are unaware of it. It's, you know, the housing needs, the employment needs, the transition needs, the school needs, all of these things are things that kind of external stuff that I need to accomplish, that I need to focus externally, and that's where I'm looking. But I'm not taking the time to sit back and consider exactly, you know, what's going on with, you know, I call it the headspace and timing, or my mindset, you know, what's happening there. I had, before graduation, about a little bit during my transition and then a little bit before graduation, my master's degree, I worked as a program director for a nonprofit called the Colorado Veterans Resource Coalition, and we ran a housing facility for veterans. And these were veterans working with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and we were contract with the VA to provide housing for homeless veterans. In the time, the 18 months that I spent there, I could see veterans, you know, coming in, coming out. We had a substance abuse program, residential program for veterans going through substance abuse treatment at the VA. You know, so we could get them connected to employment, we could get them connected to housing, we could get them suits for an interview, we could do all of these different things. But it was a challenge in getting the veteran in the right mindset to accept and hold on to or to pursue these different things. And that's when I really started to realize that the veteran's mental health and wellness, their mindset and you know, how they think the world is or should be, all that's critical to support them in their transition.
That's awesome, man. And I'm wondering, you know, in your work experience, what are some of the biggest challenges you see facing veterans today?
You know, that's a good question, Justin. I think that obviously everybody knows about PTSD and TBI, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, especially with combat veterans, but not even specifically with combat veterans, because there are many, many different ways in the military to experience traumatic events. And then traumatic brain injuries, and, you know, we used to call them concussions back in the day. And so all of these different things, that's kind of what everybody knows. But I recognize now, and I've thought for a while, that it really goes beyond just PTSD and TBI. So there's really three things, I think, and I'd like to maybe, you know, go through a little bit of each of them, and if you have any questions about that. But the first one is called moral injury. So if you think about PTSD as an injury of the behavior, you know, it is much more complicated than the way I'm about to say it, but boiled down, it is a kind of a Pavlovian response. A loud noise reminds, you know, a roadside bomb or mortars or even gunfire. And then when I get home, something that reminds me of that triggers the same behavioral or physiological response that I responded to then. So just like the ring the bell, the dog salivates. So PTSD can be considered an injury of the behavior. TBI is a physical injury of the brain, actually injury to the brain. Moral injury can be seen as an injury of the soul. So a veteran's core beliefs about what is right and wrong with the world can be changed through constant exposure to trauma or betrayal. A lot of survivor's guilt, for example, that's not explained by PTSD. The kind of the grief that veterans experience after loss is not explained by PTSD. That's something separate. And that's really where kind of moral injury. So moral injury, Jonathan Shea wrote an excellent book called Achilles in Vietnam, and it looked at how a correlation between the Vietnam veterans that he worked with in looking back at, you know, Achilles and Homer and the Iliad, and how even the correlation that far back about how, you know, betrayals or mistakes that were made or things like that, that veterans really actually internalized that, and it changed the way they thought about things that were right and wrong.
I think this is really fascinating. It's something I've looked at a lot myself, is this concept, which I think is very powerful, of limiting beliefs or limiting core beliefs or limiting core beliefs. And, you know, correct me if I'm misrepresenting this, but it's this sense that for everyone, things happen in our life, in our childhood, in our upbringing, in our service. And our mind is incredible. Our brain wants to protect us. And so it creates a view and a response. And over the years, you know, hundreds of thousands of times, we reinforce this belief to the point that it is automatic. And it's automatic in a way that doesn't even serve us. Like something that made sense when we were in the service that doesn't make sense anymore, we still respond in the same way. And so what sounds like you're saying with moral injury is that it's starting to dig into these core beliefs that have been shifted through someone's service, and how that shapes their view of the world, and getting them to realize like ways in which that view of the world might not be serving them now in their civilian life, or now that they're back from overseas. Is that somewhat right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it is when someone's core beliefs are changed, and core, you know, we learn them, obviously they're passed on to us. They're shaped by our environment. And at one point we may believe something, and then, you know, something happens, and then that belief shifts. You think about veterans who talk about when they're deployed, you know, and you know, they're really kind of on edge, maybe even fearful or anxious in the first couple, weeks or month of a combat deployment. But halfway through, they're walking around like the guy in Apocalypse Now. You know, I love the smell of napalm in the morning, and you know, nothing really. And there's this kind of emotional deadening. The environment has that impact on them. You know, think back to Abu Ghraib or My Lai back in Vietnam. The environment that an individual operates in has the potential to change their core beliefs. And at the same time, a core belief is so far underneath the conscious awareness that we don't often kind of we're not aware of it or how it affects us. You know, I often say that a lot of veterans, when they're deployed, or even in the military, anger and aggression is a positive thing. The really aggressive, the mean, the go-getters, they're rewarded. You know, they're given kudos. They're seen as people to look up to, and that's protective. It's even, you know, it kept us alive when we were deployed, but that's not effective when we're back here. And that's the kind of thing that it was very effective in one environment, and until you get back home, it's not effective in another environment. And I'm not talking about, you know, of course, My Lai and Abu Ghraib and the large stuff, but there were no stoplights in Afghanistan. There's no stop signs in Iraq. One-way streets, it's whichever way I'm going, that's the way that the one-way street is. And then the veteran who deployed and kind of went through all that, then they come back here, and they have to obey the stoplights and go the right way around the traffic circles. And they have to stand behind the lady in the checkout line that's writing a check. And so it's making that shift from the emotions that were helpful for us there and making it so that we change that and we recognize they're not helpful. A lot of veterans maybe don't realize that that's the case.
And it sounds like the first step in this moral injury is just starting to recognize that it's there, just starting to be aware of the influences that shape our behavior and our beliefs, and just noticing them and being aware that they're there. Is that right? Kind of the starting point there?
No, I mean, that's exactly it. And the awareness is key for any recovery, but especially for veterans. Being aware that there's a problem is the first stepping off point. Sometimes we come to that awareness by ourselves, but other times somebody else makes us aware. Maybe a spouse or a child, a parent, the police officer, you know, somebody else says, hey, there's a problem here, and brings that to the veteran's awareness and their attention. But absolutely, I think that awareness is key. And so, and that's really, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, I know that there's, I think two other tenets that you want to go through, but one thing I just want to address, and I'm not even sure how to phrase this, but, so I believe very, very deeply in what you're talking about and doing. And I just noticed that there's part of me when you're saying this, this part from the Naval Academy, this part from the military, that is, it's so easy to dismiss what you're saying and to think like, you know, tough it out or, oh, whatever, or, oh, this is just some, you know, like there's a part from my military background that becomes very easy to dismiss what you're saying and kind of trying to convince myself like, oh, just push through, or, oh, that's for people who are weak or things like that. And I imagine you must get this a lot. I'm wondering, what do you say to someone listening where they might think like, oh, this doesn't apply to me, or this is the soft side of stuff that I don't need?
Well, the first thing I'll do is I'll say, you're absolutely right in recognizing where it came from. I spent 3 years stationed at Fort Meade and went down to Annapolis a couple times. So I'm definitely not as familiar with the Naval Academy as you are. Beautiful place, wonderful. But the military academies have a very rigid, you know, we're here in Colorado Springs with the Air Force Academy and West Point as well. They have a very structured way. Not that they, you know, it's brainwashing, but there is the warrior ethos and that is developed in you. And so I'd say, yes, absolutely. You are recognizing that that's the case. The point that I make is just because that was the case then does not need to be the case now. Recognizing that it is a barrier. And then I say, well, is that going to help you? Is thinking that, oh, this is just for weak people and things like that. Okay, fine. You know, you can continue to go on thinking that way or thinking that this is going to happen. And then maybe sometime down the line, something more catastrophic may happen. I mean, it's almost like ignoring the check engine light. You know, you can pay the $250 to fix whatever the problem is now, or pay the $1,000 or $1,800 to fix the big problem later.
Oh, I love that. And I love what you said, that just because it was the case then does not mean it's the case now. And I think one thing that I've realized later in life is that it's not always good or bad, black or white, right or wrong. And one of the things that jumps out as you're saying this is it's recognizing the good and bad of our training and saying like, look, the good aspect of this military training is I have been able to push through incredible things in my life. I've been able to dig deep and power through circumstances. And the flip side of that is that many times I may try to do that when that doesn't serve me. And it's even detrimental to me to continue to power through or grind the gears or just kind of push through when it would be more advantageous to back off or look at things differently. So I love that duality, it sounds like, in what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, there is that balance. I think that there is a point, especially for veterans as they're going through their military career, where they're not aware of their capacity to be able to handle, you know, whatever's put in front of them. You think, especially for enlisted soldiers, you know, basic training, or for you guys, you know, Hell Week or Beast Barracks or you know, plebe year, you know, or whatever it is, you know, but that very first intense introduction, that a lot of people, some people don't make it through, but you get beyond that and you're like, wow, I had more in me than I thought. And so the military stretches you and grows your capacity. But then, yes, there is a point where maybe sometimes you think that you have greater capacity than you actually do. I experienced that myself. I told you I got hurt on a jump in 2012. When I left Bragg in 99, I was jumping, you know, every other week. I jumped something like 16 times in 6 months. I was just, you know, jumping out of airplanes every chance I could get. But then at the end of my career, you know, I wasn't 25 anymore. I was, you know, a little bit heavier, a little bit older and all this other stuff. And I couldn't recover quite as quickly. And I still jumped twice after I hurt myself on that jump in 2012 because I did not recognize what my limits were. And that's exactly, that's a very physical illustration of what you were talking about. But we do the same things with ourselves mentally. We're going to power through this. I'm not going to seek help, all this other stuff.
That's great. And you were you kind of had started off at talking about how moral injury was the first of these kind of traits. What were the other ones?
So another thing that veterans really find themselves challenged with is it's learned helplessness. And so learned helplessness came out of Martin Seligman and he's the University of Pennsylvania, has the concept of learned helplessness, and it's the idea of if an individual is in a situation where it's so unbearable that they can't escape out of it, that it really takes them to a place of depression. A lot of the early experiments were done on dogs, and Dr. Seligman really, you know, talks very closely about his struggle with that piece. But it's the idea of dogs who found that they were unwilling or unable to escape an inescapable shock, that they just laid there and they just, you know, they took it. And it goes back, you know, you think, you know, a Springsteen song, Born in the USA, you know, kick like a dog that's been beat too much. And, you know, and it's that kind of thing that veterans will experience if they get out of the service and they think that there's nothing that I can do to change this situation. If there's literally nothing I can do, I can't get a job because nobody's hiring. I can't get out of this relationship. I can't, you know, I can't do this. I can't do that. And if they find themselves in that really stuck place, then it's more likely they're going to stay there. And it's sort of, so it's the opposite of the resilience and the response that we had in the military. And a lot of veterans can get stuck and learn to be helpless. And once the learned helplessness kicks in, it's really kind of hard to regenerate that willingness, desire to get up and move.
Yeah, I can just I can obviously see how that would flow over then into the issues you were talking about before of homelessness and job troubles and all these other things. This sense of helplessness and kind of futility would bleed into every area of your life.
Right. I mean, and this is you know, you hear it a lot. I think or I know in the military, especially deployed, you know. I'm being sent down this route. It's a black route, and I have no choice but to go down it. We're going to get hit again. We might as well just do it. I mean, and it just becomes this kind of, like you said, an exercise in futility. Nothing I can do will remove this aversive condition from my life, and so I might as well just not even try. And then that starts to bleed over into kind of how the veteran sees the world. If there's no point, then I might as well not even fight. Once we start to accept that as truth, then that becomes our truth. If we deny that and create something else as our truth, then we can actually get out of that pit.
And so we've got moral injury, learned helplessness. What was the other challenge?
And the last one is really a lack of meaning and purpose. And this goes really to, you know, existential psychology, Viktor Frankl and Erwin Yalom, in that, you know, in various different ways. Yeah, in the military, we were small cogs in a very large machine, but we also had a lot of meaning and purpose in our life. Even if that meaning and purpose were our brothers and sisters to the left and right, the mission that we conducted, the importance that we have, you know, you hear the stories of, you know, the young commander that, you know, that had, you know, officer of the watch or the squad leader who, you know, responsible for $1 million of equipment and 7 lives in Southern Afghanistan. And now all of a sudden they come back home, and they go to work for a bank, and all they're doing is answering phones or counting out money. I mean, and so there is a significant lack of meaning and purpose in their lives. It's not something that the veteran is working towards, something that is bigger than themselves. And I see that an awful lot with a lot of the veterans, is that if they don't have something to fill that hole, to fill that space, then something's going to fill the space, you know, and it could be, you know, not good for them, drinking or drugs or, you know, destructive relationships or things like that. And so that's a huge aspect of when a veteran gets out, if they don't find anything meaningful and purposeful in their lives, then that could lead to some challenges as well.
Do you have any thoughts on, because I do think that, you know, in all the conversations I've had, it is such a big realignment when someone transitions out of the military into the civilian workforce. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on or advice about how they might go about uncovering a new purpose. Because I imagine in a lot of situations, people are, you know, they're almost starting over again of like, what is my purpose? What is my mission? What is my meaning?
Right. I think one of the things, Justin, is exactly what you said earlier, is just the awareness piece. Having the awareness that where I find myself, does it fulfill me? Does it satisfy me? Is this something that I enjoy? And this is not everybody's going to get out and get their dream job. I absolutely understand that. There are going to be times where the need that I have, how I fulfill my need, is just to put bread on the table or keep the family in the house. And I get that. But then you don't have to be stuck in that. I had the opportunity as I was transitioning and I was looking. I hadn't considered working in the nonprofit field, but I had a chance meeting with another service member. He and I served as first sergeants together. And he was working in a nonprofit that helped veterans find jobs, you know. And he said that, you know, when we senior NCOs or even, you know, junior officers or senior officers, when leaders get out, find a reason to do something, find meaning and purpose. And he's like, you'll sleep so much better at night when you're actually working for something rather than just working for a paycheck. And it really helped me, even when I was as a program director of the nonprofit for housing and homeless veterans. It was meaningful because it was an extension of what I did as a leader in the Army. Now, even then, I noticed, you know, that was a lot more like social work for me. That's not what I wanted to do. It was something similar to what I wanted to do, but I really wanted to work one-on-one directly with veterans in a counseling setting. So I shifted. It wasn't a 180-degree shift. It wasn't, you know, totally. But it was something that, you know, yeah, this is good, but it's not exactly what I wanted. So just generating that awareness of, is where I am going to be satisfying to me? And if it's not, that's one of the big things that I think veterans don't realize, is you don't have to stay anymore. You know, when we were in the military, you were assigned to the ship you were assigned to. You couldn't go to another ship. I mean, it wasn't that easy. You know, I was assigned to the unit that I was assigned in, and it wasn't as easy as me saying, you know what, I'm going to put in my letter of resignation. So that good then goes back to learned helplessness. Veterans like, oh, you know, well, you know, I told this guy that I'd be here for 6 months or I'd stick it out. The loyalty piece is there, you know, the fear of stepping out in the unknown. So they find themselves stuck rather than really fulfilling something meaningful and purposeful in their lives.
That's great. And I just love that sense of awareness again. And it's something I don't think I was aware of how much purpose and meaning the military brought me while I was on active duty. And I think in a lot of these interviews that comes through as well, is that people might not, especially for those of us that served for 5 or 7 years, we might not know how much that affects our identity and our personal drive. And so I love that sense of just being aware that, hey, no matter who you are, most likely you're going to sense that loss and try and find some way to fill that. And like you said, that makes life much more rich and much more meaningful.
Right. And then, and in making it more rich and meaningful, it elevates mood. It brings more positive thought, and it gets you, you know, it gets people, not just veterans, but that's what follows from finding meaning and purpose and fulfillment in your life is a better state of wellness. You know, it's a veteran mental health isn't about diagnosing and isn't about illness. It's about wellness and making and helping ourselves be the best us that we could possibly be.
That's great. And I'm wondering, are there any resources that you would recommend that could be books, websites, groups to any veteran listening? I know that one of them you already mentioned was Achilles in Vietnam, and I'll add a link to that to the show notes. But any other resources you would recommend?
You know, a lot of different things that I give to veterans. And I mentioned Viktor Frankl, but Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, it's actually kind of split up into two parts. But the first part is Frankl's experience while he was in a concentration camp in World War II. And the first time I read that, I mean, especially because I think the first time I read it was after I'd had at least two or three deployments, that it resonated so much with me, a lot of the concepts that he was talking about. And so especially from the existential standpoint and talking about man's search for meaning, or talking about meaning and purpose, Man's Search for Meaning is a very, very good book to really take a look at.
I actually just finished about a week ago that book, and I completely agree. I think it's very, very powerful.
And, you know, I like it for the second half to talk about logotherapy. That's, you know, it's really talking about the technical aspects of Frankl's concept of logotherapy. But even just the first half of the book, I mean, there's excerpts of that book that I've you know, taken with groups of veterans and really been able to help them understand just what that lack of a sense of meaning and purpose is. Another book, and this is really about the learned helplessness, Martin Seligman's book, Learned Optimism, is a really great resource to talk about learned helplessness and learn about learned helplessness, but also to realize that, you know, we don't have to kind of remain pessimists. That we can actually learn to do something different and learn to think differently. So Learned Optimism by Seligman is another good resource. Regarding mental health or psychology or veteran psychology, I really like Dave Grossman's books. He has two different books, On Combat and On Killing. And so they have a really good insight into how you know, how military, how combat, how, you know, obviously the act of killing or things like that affect people differently. You know, I've talked to veterans. One of the things I think On Killing that Dave Grossman talks about is the proximity of the killing really matters. But let's say that you were on a ship at sea and that ship was, you know, maybe kicking out aircraft or, you know, shooting onto land or things like that. The concept of the crew being involved in part of killing is something they really don't kind of consider because it's so far removed. Whereas somebody who is, for example, a sniper or somebody that's operating in close combat, it impacts them differently. And so those two books are some really good insight, even for veterans themselves, to understand a little bit more about what happens behaviorally, psychologically. And then there's another resource. There is a documentary that came out last year, Veterans Day last year, and it's called Acronym, the Cross-Generational Battle with PTSD. And so it's from a local company here in Colorado called Mountain Time Media. And the director, Stephen Tubbs, he's a journalist, but he spent some time in Afghanistan, I believe, but he was embedded as a reporter. And the stuff that he saw, he realized that this was a very important message. And so the movie, it doesn't just look at PTSD from a post 9/11 standpoint. PTSD wasn't even identified as a diagnosable condition until 80 or 81. But this takes veterans from World War II. They had a veteran who was in Pearl Harbor, Korean War, of course, Vietnam veterans, looking at the impact of post-traumatic stress disorder and some of this other stuff that I was talking about is wrapped into it. But also takes a look at maybe some of the alternative therapies, not just standard, talk therapy, but also some of the alternative therapies that are available for veterans. And the thing I really like about the documentary is it actually brings in mental health professionals and says, okay, so there is a standard known quantity method of mental health counseling that can support you. And then there are some other things that can help kind of along the way, equine therapy. There's a section on there about how, golf, to play golf well, to play golf anyway, but to play golf well takes concentration, and those kind of things help build, build up your brain, essentially build synapses and helps you focus and concentrate, and it complements the traditional kind of therapies. And so I would definitely recommend that anybody take a look at Acronym in Mountain Time Media on their website. They have a trailer there in a way to get a copy of the movie.
Great. And for listeners, I'll put links to all of the books that Dwayne mentioned, as well as the documentary in the show notes. I want to make sure I leave a good chunk of the room here at the end, just to give you a space to share anything else you'd want to say to veteran listeners right now. I know that you've answered a lot of great questions for me, but what have I not asked about that you'd want listeners to know?
I think the big thing is stigma, and you kind of touched on it a little earlier, is that when you were talking about the cadet in me or the service member in me is just kind of resisting against this, the stigma against veterans' mental health, it's starting to change in the military a little bit, but it's not yet, I think, changing in the veterans themselves. And I kind of equate it as an external stigma versus an internal stigma. I have a pretty recognizable Jeep. It's one of the things that I do. You kind of put stuff on and take stuff off. And so people who know me, they know that that's my Jeep. And when I was in the military, sometimes it would have been a little better to see my Jeep outside of a strip club or a bar, as opposed to seeing it outside the mental health counseling agency. That was really the, there was actually a GAO study that came out earlier this year that indicate that kind of is a little alive and well, but that's also starting to change. A lot of the senior leaders are saying, look, after this long, I'm needing to get help. Other people need to get help. So there is a shift in that kind of external stigma in the military, but there is still a resistance inside the veteran even though I have all of the symptoms for PTSD, don't tell me I have PTSD, because that's just another label. It will threaten my security clearance, or it will threaten my, whatever, just all of these preconceived notions of barriers put inside, the veterans put inside themselves. There still maybe is a stigma in the community. There's an idea that veterans are seen as one of three ways. Either they're a victim, they're this broken winged bird that needs to be nursed back to life, you poor baby, all this, or they're a villain, they're a crazy combat vet that's about to explode any minute now. Or they're seen as some kind of mythic hero, some kind of vindicator that will stand up. And none of those things are really true. No veteran that I've ever known wants to be treated like a victim. You know, they'll resist that. They'll, being labeled a villain or in some way aggressive or something, that could make them more aggressive. And a lot of villains or a lot of veterans will resist against being called a hero. You know, that I know heroes, but I'm not a hero. And so there are these kind of archetypes that maybe the community sees. When you see veteran, you see one of these three things. But in reality, we're really kind of a combination of all of them. And so that's really as far as the stigma. But then there's a stigma against therapy and mental health itself. Just the idea of they think it's, you know, somebody sitting on the floor burning incense, cross-legged with beach scenes on the wall or something like that. And those ideas that veterans have in their mind that, well, you know, they're just going to want me to lay on a couch and talk about my mother. That's not necessarily true. So it's really kind of, you know, understanding that all of these different stigmas exist, and if we buy into them, then they're more of a barrier for us to get help.
That's great. And I, you know, personally, I'm a huge advocate of if whatever avenue it takes, whether it's therapy, whether it's coaching, leadership coaching, executive coaching, you know, the way that I look at this is that if you're training for the Olympics, no one does that alone. And you have right. someone there who's pushing you, challenging you, pointing out things that you might not see yourself. And it's no different on our mental and emotional front. And so, yeah, I'm just a big fan and advocate of the work that you're doing. And like you said, I think it's tremendously needed for the veteran community. I think it's needed for people in general, not just veterans. But I think it's great to hear that you are doing work to reverse the parts of that stigma that still remain.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's the thing. You have it exactly right. It's not a matter of fixing what's broken. It's making something that's less functional more functional, making something that is problematic in your life to become better. You know, I tell guys all the time that awareness piece. If you're living in a bus in the woods like Gary Busey and Black Sheep, you know, as long as you know why you're doing it, and you're not hurting yourself and you're not hurting anybody else and you know, you're not violating any laws, then fine, as long as you know why you're doing it. But if you find yourself living in the woods and you don't know why you're doing it and, you know, and people have to call and describe what vehicle they're in and how many people are there before they come over, then that's a challenge. That's not you living to your fullest potential. So the awareness piece and understanding why is really a big takeaway for me.
And I love that phrase you had of you living to your full potential. And I think that that's what a lot of this is about, is just constant growth and constant just living to your full potential and finding things that keep us from doing that or ways that we could be better and more efficient and just smarter about the way that we do things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you very much. I know we're running up on the end of our time here together, but I appreciate not just your joining today and sharing more about your work, but also just the work that you're doing to help veterans. And for listeners, I'll add in the show notes, I'll speak with Dwayne afterwards and get some of his favorite or more popular articles and link there as well. And would encourage you to check out his work at veteranmentalhealth.com, where you can read a lot about his work and his experience. So thank you very much, Dwayne.
Okay, thank you, Justin. It was great.
Surface, surface, surface.
Thanks for listening. As we wrap up, I wanted to share three quick but important announcements. First of all, if you haven't already, please sign up for my newsletter at beyondtheuniform.io. Although I publish on LinkedIn and Facebook, I'll be starting to use the newsletter as my primary means to share new articles, episodes, and resources relevant to the veteran community. Second, I would love to hear from you. Sometimes I feel like I'm in a relationship where I do all of the talking. You can view me as your very own dedicated resource to help you and other veterans in your civilian career. Have feedback on what I can do differently? Let me know. Someone in particular you want me to track down for an interview? I'm all ears. Know of another way that I could help the veteran community? I'm dying to know. You can find me on LinkedIn, comment on any post at beyondtheuniform.io, email me at justin@beyondtheuniform.io, or if you're in the intel industry, I'm sure you can track me down in some super creepy way. However you do it, take me up on it. I thrive on feedback. Lastly, a quick plug for a few resources I think would benefit any veteran. American Corporate Partners and Service to School both provide free assistance to any veteran. American Corporate Partners pairs you with a mentor in your desired industry, and Service to Schools finds a mentor at a suitable undergrad or graduate school program to help you with your application. Check them out. As always, tons of great content and resources available at beyonduniform.io. I'm Justin Nasiri, and I'll be back soon with more great episodes.